as well as Nathan Gomezulu. And I can see that Mr. Fangas is left over here in this committee room because he always gets disadvantaged whenever we have this meeting. He will always be shifted back to the list. So seemingly today he's not prepared to be shifted back to the list, because when we were opening this door, he was already so Mr. Fangas, you are protected. Nobody is going to shift you today. on a serious note, you are all welcome in this meeting, and this is a very, very, very serious meeting, because we are in a course in preparation of the budget vote, and our interest is to understand the plans and the targets that are set by the department for in making sure that we really deliver services that are sustainable as well as quality services to the people of this country. So this is our second session in respect of that. We started with the department and the couple of housing institutions. Now we're supposed to be wrapping up with the institutions, but unfortunately it means, honorable members, NETA, we still have NETA outstanding because last time they didn't vote what we are supposed to be presenting to the committee, before the committee. So we are left with NETA as well as the we are expecting business, provincial business plans, which means first week when we come back from the recess on the 16th and 17th, we're going to have a meeting with Neville. I'm sure that time, by that time, you will be ready with the provincial business plans, so that we will wrap up, because I understand that on the 9th we are debating. So we must be prepared on time, and there's FSC that I believe we have to meet with them, and there's another group that has requested to comment on the threat plan, departmental threat plan. That group is what is this called? The Law Society, UWC. So in terms of public participation, if there are people who would like to comment on something, they have to be given that opportunity, of which on that day we will invite the department to come to that session, so that they can also respond to some of the issues. So I thought it is important that I notify the department on time, but I'm not sure about the date, but you will be notified about that. we are going to continue. There's no tea today. Assuming we are being put into a hunger strike, it's not us. We'll put ourselves to that sort of coming. But I think in a few minutes they are coming. They get lost in the mist. So let's continue, and then we'll see what to do. Mr. Fagazi, before we do that, let's introduce ourselves. Just a quick introduction, and I understand that there's a few apologies from Honorable Nisi. They are undertaking an oversight to Russia, as well as Hasmume. Then Honorable... Uhasmone has been redeployed. I got discharged from anywhere. No people have been discharged. They are redeployed. no. there is the plant, so it means she is no longer serving in this committee, Honorable Hasbon. And then Honorable Machoba and Honorable Doris have undertaken an oversight, one with transport and other one with local government. So those are the only apologies that I have on my table. Oh, Honorable Stone has gotten an apology too. So I think Honorable Mkhalaba is on his way because we met yesterday. He confirmed that he's coming. Can you just make a quick introduction, Honorable Borman?
Yes, I'm Gloria Borman. Good morning, member of this committee.
Good morning. I'm Jabu Sosibo, member of the committee.
Mon Makosa Zananjobi, member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Jan Maritz. I'm from the National Department of Human Settlements.
Morning, I'm Maurice Ngomezolo from the National Department of Human Settlements.
Good morning, Sean Solomon from the National Department of Human Settlements.
Morning, Tamano Batala from the National Department.
Good morning, Anna Mukhadinyan, National Department.
Thank you, Chair. Neville Cheney from the National Department of Human Settlements. Chair, just to note the apologies of the Director General, which he indicated to yourself as well yesterday. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Pam Benny from PM. Good morning, I'm Pam Benny from PNG.
Good morning, everybody. Mili Lekhaba, Assistant to the Director General.
Good morning, Mona Lester from Housing Development Agency.
Good morning, Taffy Adler, Housing Development Agency. Madam Chair, if I can just indicate that for the first time Mary Lester appears, she's our new General Manager of Land. And I think you did meet Rashida Issel, who's on my left, who is our Corporate Services Manager. Mr. Leshabani had a problem with his car, he's on his way. But behind me is the executive of the HDA, and I think Mr. Leshabani and I would like you to note the gender composition of our executive.
Rashida Issel, HDA. Roxana Muller, CFO, HDA. Kate Chan Communications, HDA.
Odette Crofton, Projects and Programs, HDA.
Good morning, my name is Koli Sapasi, Committee Secretary.
Good morning, my name is Tata Makanye, I'm the researcher.
Good morning, my name is Javan Sarazi with Ralph.
I'm Bruce Gordon, also with Ralph.
Thank you very much. We can proceed, Mr. Farazi.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the members of the committee. I'll do the presentation together with my colleague, Bruce Gordon, who is the new CFO of RALF. That is the outline of our presentation. We'll just briefly touch on our mandate and then talk about the broad policy context in which we operate and look at situational analysis, mainly a business environment that affects RALF business. And then strategic outcomes, and then we'll talk about corporate governance issues, and then have concluding remarks. In terms of our mandate, Chairperson, our mandate is to enable people in rural areas to access finance so that they can incrementally improve their housing conditions. And in terms of rural, the definition in our mandate is that it covers communal land, rural towns and small towns. It's not just rural in the traditional sense of the word. And then we focus on low-income earners, people earning 9,800 and less. But as you see in our targets, our key focus is people who are earning 3,500 and less. 60% of our loans are targeted towards the people who are in that income band. As a government-owned entity, we operate within a policy environment. One, we have to look at opportunities that the policy environment presents to the RAF business. But secondly, we also have to look at how we could, as RALF, contribute towards achievement of policy imperatives. As a human settlements entity, we contribute directly towards the achievement of sustainable human settlements within our mandate in rural areas by enabling people in rural areas to improve their housing conditions on an incremental basis, mainly because of affordability levels. In terms of outcome aid, we are also contributing directly there because we enable people to access informal housing finance loans so that they can improve their living space. And we have seen also borrowers taking loans basically to build permanent houses in informal settlements. So we are contributing to the upgrading of informal households. And other people are taking loans so that they can build rental units in their backyards and in the process basically help themselves to have income stream that they use to improve their living conditions. As the only human settlements-owned entity focusing in rural areas, we also have to support the government rural development program by ensuring that people residing in rural nodes are also able to access finance that they can use to improve their housing conditions in rural areas. So as the committee would note, annually we actually track the number of loans that go to the deep rural nodes and present those in our annual report. We also contribute to SME development. A number of our intermediaries started as SMEs, some are still SMEs. So by providing funding to them, we enable them to get into the business of lending money for housing purpose, and in the process, that supports job creation in those businesses. Recently, the government announced the National Development Plan. We think going forward, that presents opportunities for us, both in terms of contributing to the development of our country. There are two chapters in the NDP which we think link directly to what we do. All the chapters of the NDP we think are important in terms of improving the economic development and development in general of the country. But two chapters that I think basically pertain directly to what we do. One is inclusive rural economy. We have seen the targets there in terms of what the government is trying, will be doing to improve rural economy by creating opportunities in the agricultural value chain and creating a number of job opportunities. I think the target is about 1 million, I think, by 2030. So that will give us an opportunity, basically, to support those people who will benefit from the development of the rural economy to access finance so that they can improve their housing conditions over time. And another chapter is transforming rural settlements. We believe this chapter is also important in terms of presenting opportunities for us to provide finance to communities in the human settlements in rural areas so that they can improve their housing conditions as well. In the State of the Nation address, the President made huge announcements around infrastructure development. That presents a number of opportunities for RALF. First, people in rural areas will see increased utilities. So there will be therefore a huge demand for loans for connections from our intermediaries. There will be new construction work that will be undertaken during the implementation of the infrastructure development programs. And we believe that over time, improved living standards will be realized in the area in which we land. In essence, there will be huge partial restructuring. I think they talk about transport development corridors. So basically, that will create, I would say, new settlements, which our intermediaries have to target so they can offer housing finance so that people can improve their housing conditions or build new homes in those new areas. So there will be new jobs that will be created because of the construction in the course of construction infrastructure development, I mean, projects. So job creation, therefore, will result in new owners who have income and want to build their new homes or improve their existing homes. So there will be a demand for housing loans because, as you know, because of affordability levels and also building in rural areas, so the option for many people in rural areas to access finance that they can use to build incrementally because they don't have mortgage, I mean, finance available in that market. So RALS, therefore, going forward, we believe we'll need to have funding so that we can respond, I mean, to that demand. In terms of business environment, I mean, Chairperson, I think from what we have seen, I mean, recently and currently what we expect also going forward is that the economic conditions are not looking that rosy. I mean, for people in target market, it's low-income earners. Many of them remain unemployed. I mean, since the last recession, very, very few jobs have been brought back, you know. So the industry really that has been creating more jobs has been government in recent times. But if you look at the global economy as well, there are very, very, I would say, slim prospects that will see huge job creation in the private sector. The inflation is on the upside. The last recorded figure is 6.3. And possibly going forward, we might see more as a result of rising food prices, energy costs, you know, fuel costs, you know, because of geopolitics conditions in the Middle East in particular. And as you know, low-income earners use a large proportion of their income to pay for transport costs to go to work. So that tends to basically erode the disposable income that they should have in order to afford taking housing loans. The levels of indebtedness in our country remain very, very, very high. And it's a concern, despite the fact that the interest rates are at lowest levels in about 3 decades, but that hasn't really made a significant dent in terms of people reducing their levels of indebtedness. So those adverse economic conditions have implications for our business. What we have seen in the industry, we have seen big players coming to our industry with high consolidations, giving loans basically which are not necessarily leading to people taking loans for housing purposes, but consolidating borrowers, I mean, in our client base. We've seen a high rejection rate from intermediaries, which show that people basically are sort of stressed in terms of levels of indebtedness and affordability of loans. There's huge competition also in our market, which means, as Ralph, while we are supporting our traditional intermediaries, we also have to explore, I mean, and try to break new ground in terms of identifying new type of entities that we can work with, such as your CBOs. Collection rates, I mean, in this market will be basically a great challenge, which means as well we'll have to provide more in terms of bad debts. But importantly, because we want to focus on impact in terms of our mandate, there's a huge risk of higher of leakage, because under hard, you know, times, people will take loans just to make ends meet, put food on the table rather than investing, you know, in their housing development. That's a risk for us. So another implication is that some of our low-risk clients who are giving us impact, they could be tempted basically to provide loans not necessarily for housing, but to respond them into their competitors. Because what, as I've indicated, many are complaining of, you know, debt consolidation, so they may want to give the type of loan so that they retain their customers as well. But for us, that's leakage in terms of impact. In terms of funding, we are grateful to the department and the government and our government in that in the last two financial years, we received 99 million, which came to us in two tranches, 45.9 in 2010-11, and then 45.9 in 2012. In the next financial year, we are expecting to receive 32 million. So what all this means, it means that in our portfolio of intermediaries, we have to have a balanced portfolio. Well-established clients, what we have done with the board, we have increased the exposure limit to maximum of 25% of capital employed. And the idea here is that these entities are big enough, they have national footprint, so they give us high impact in all 9 provinces. But because of the challenges that we face in terms of signing up new clients, We cannot say we'll sit with money, but we'll have to deploy money for development, and these entities will help us to achieve just that. So in the next 3 years, the board has approved that we increase the maximum exposure limit to 25%, and then we'll review the situation going forward. But while we are doing that, we'll also try to increase intermediate entities and pursue CBOs, basically so that we can also achieve impact and build channels, I mean, for the future. We have high-risk entities in our stable where we'll have to really sort of balance risk and impact. So we'll have to support those who are giving us impact and help those who are finding it difficult to give us impact to improve their impact contribution to us. We'll share with you in the next slide how we're planning to do that. Internally, Chairperson, RALF remains a very small team, but very, very dedicated in terms of achieving the mandate. Currently, we have all positions filled except for one position, Chief Operations Officer. The board decided that it will postpone filling this position until the level of activity of RALF increases. Another consideration that the board has also taken is the current DFI consultation process. The board also wanted to see how far that process goes and how fast it moves before it fills that position, because it might have implications in terms of consolidation. What we're planning to do, Honorable Chairperson and the committee, is that in the next financial year, RALF will appoint two interns to focus solely on monitoring impact. This is very important, I mean, for us, because it has been a challenge that we tend to rely more on clients reporting the impact figures to us. But and what we need to do is to basically also verify on a continuous basis the report that they submit to us. In the past, we do distinct surveys and do a sort of comprehensive impact survey every 2 years or 3 years. So, but we think it's important that we monitor impact on a continuous basis. As I've indicated, RALF supports the DFI review and consultation. RALF is a very, very small entity, but we believe that being part of the bigger, you know, human settlements entity will give us a muscle to be able to have a huge impact in our target market. As a government entity, we link with the provincial government as well as local government, so we continue to engage with provinces so that we can support housing delivery in those provinces. And especially what we are trying to get is where service sites have been delivered so that we can position our intermediaries to market incremental housing finance products in those markets. We are also working with the department's capacity building unit in terms of providing counselor training on human settlements issues. That's the organogram, Chairperson, of the RALF team. So all those positions are filled except for the two impact development monitoring interns, which we're planning to fill in the next financial year, and also the CEO position under operations unit, which remains vacant, as I've indicated. The subsidy voucher program, we have just made a provision in terms of where it will be located in our structure. But there's no provision in terms of budget, I mean, at this point on that one. let me take this opportunity to give our CFO the opportunity to take you through the rest of the presentation.
Thanks, Shaya. Okay, I think what we found is with our current intermediaries, they're having to compete very strongly with the banks. What ultimately means is that RALF has achieved its initial objective, which was to ensure there was money available in the rural areas. When RALF started 12 years ago, nobody lent into those areas. Now we're seeing the intermediaries we formed lending somewhere in the region of about 3 billion rand of outstanding books sitting there, and the large banks are now coming in and competing. What it does mean is that we could, that with those commercial banks coming in, they're looking at increasing the debt levels of people there without actually any benefit to them. They're consolidating debts, charging fees, and all that does is extend the people's time in debt without them doing any improvements. It's an issue we're looking at addressing with the NCR about how we can actually improve that area. But what it does mean is that from a RAF perspective is that the number of loans that our intermediaries are issuing is on the decline at the moment. What we do, if you look at our targets, number of end user loans that we are dispersing, you'll see that that's actually our target is actually dropping there, and that's because of the problems our intermediaries are experiencing. The way we're addressing that is we're going to be looking at community-based organizations, stock sales, unions, livestock associations, and seeing if we can lend through them. We think that that will be a higher maintenance thing. We'll have to hold hands a lot more. We suspect a lot of them will actually be using manual systems rather than computers to run their books, which means we need to monitor and help them there, which I think is something we need to do to make sure we're getting this impact and that we're getting out to people. It will also enable us to extend our reach into people who actually are unbanked at the moment. A community-based organization doesn't lend on a bank statement or a payslip. They lend on, I know who you are and where you are. There are, I believe, 11 million people getting social grants cash, which means they don't have bank accounts and can't access any of the current intermediaries. The targets we've put here are what we call our initial targets. That's what we get our salaries for. We're working on our bonus systems that we will only get to a system where we'll only get bonuses if we beat these targets. And that's where we feel that we should be moving away from a bonus for doing our day jobs to a bonus for achieving those stretches. In terms of our funding, we've received, as JJ said, $100 million in capital from government. We don't get any expenditure grant from government. We fund ourselves out of the interest income we earn from our intermediaries. We're expecting another $32 million this year, which will help us increase the ability to on-lend. And going forward, I think as we start to build up the community-based organizations, we will need to keep increasing our capital base, whether through government grants or if there are other areas that we may explore later. But at this stage, we haven't budgeted for any of those because we don't actually know what the effect of our research into community-based organizations will be. Okay, we will have to start repaying this KfW loan that we received. That will start in December 2014. Our cash flows support that, so it's not a big issue there, but obviously we do need to find a replacement so that we don't start to reduce the amount of capital we have out there. We are a very sound organization. I think when I came in, I realized that we've had clean audit reports, I think, virtually since the organisation started, and that I see that as that should be a given for a CFO to have a clean audit report. It's thereafter the CFO must develop the organisation, and that's what we and are looking at as a partnership between us to make this organisation achieve increased impact going forward. We're not really here for any impact. We're not here for good financials. The good financials must be given. I think we've shown you the detail of the expenses. I'm not going to read through it for you. In terms of our governance, we have a full board of directors. We've had a few resignations. The board has decided not to replace those because it was a fairly big board. We actually one board member per employee. We're now down to 7 members. It does seem to be working pretty well, that board. The different committees they're on. The only executive on the board is Mr. Fakazi, the CEO. Make sure we've got a very good independently operated board. These are the various committees of the board. We're going to be going through a process now of revising their terms of reference to make sure that they are aligned with best practice currently and keep up to date with all the PFMA and Treasury regulation requirements. Our internal audit is outsourced, so there's no risk of them worrying about their jobs with us, which does make for a good internal audit team. I'll give over to JJ to give the concluding remarks.
Thank you, Bruce. Chairperson, we look at 2013 as the year that will be a great challenge, mainly because of the global uncertainties and the implications for the domestic economy. The high levels of indebtedness that you referred to will remain a challenge, I mean, during the next financial year, and will affect adversely our people or the people in our target market. But however, we recognize the interventions that our government, I mean, has launched, like the infrastructure development program. We believe that will contribute to job creation. But in the short term, we know that there will be a lead time in terms of planning for those infrastructure development projects before we really see, you know, the job creation on the ground. But we think we do have sufficient financial resources to respond should the market conditions, for whatever reason, improve drastically in the medium-term period so that we can be able to meet the demand of the internal housing finance loans. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farazi. Sana Purana, you are welcome, Honorable Mashishi, and Honorable Mukhalata. Honorable Mukhalata, Kalina. May we interact with the presentation?
We had a chance at the beginning, Chair. All right. First of all, thank you very much for the presentation. And obviously, we are operating in difficult times, but it's good to see that there's a very positive input here, and obviously, it's extremely welcomed. I wonder if, it's good to see your link also with the National Planning Commission and the identification of the, you know, the opportunities that is going to bring. I wonder if I could just, I wonder where I should start. Let me start with the corporate governance issues. I see that you are saying that your board is functioning well, and I would like to know how many meetings you have in a year. I don't see that here. And also to comment that you have a good gender mix, I notice. To also ask what is the relationship between the board chair and the CEO? What sort of a working relationship you have there. And then obviously your committees are extremely important, particularly audit and risk committees, and I'm given to understand that that is functioning well. The internal audit, just a question I have there, and that is you talk about outsourcing. There's been some discussion recently about sticking with the same external auditors for too long. Do you have one external auditor that you are, outsourcing auditors that you are working with, or does that change? If we could have just some indication of that. I want to also then, if I may, Chair, may I do another section here? I want to refer to your slide on your key performance area statement of financial performance and your operating expenses. I would just like to talk to that. On page 14 of your report, and it just gives me slightly bigger figures to work with here than what you have got, there seems to be, let me just, whilst I'm working on the board, refer to the fees that are paid at a rate of 4,500 rand per meeting to your members. Does this include traveling? Is it an all-inclusive fee that is paid, or is there something separate for that? And then, if I can, just go to that, the operating expenses. And it would seem to me from this slide that your actuals, your budgeted amount for March and 2011 and the actuals, there seems to be quite a big drop. And, you know, if we could just have some explanation of that, if I'm understanding it correctly. And then to refer to your staff costs, those have dropped. But if I look at, there was something here with computers. Did I find that that I wanted to refer to? Anyway, let's just stick with that at the moment. And, you know, your marketing expenses have dropped tremendously. Your consulting legal fees. What is the reason for the big drop as opposed to what you have budgeted for? I'll pick up on something else later. I want to find something. There was a computer issue that I wanted to raise. I'll come back on that, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to confirm if the picture of the house that we see on the cover page on page one, sorry, is probably a house that was built from a loan from Ralph. And also, for me, it would be interesting, for instance, if one could be able to know, I know it's quite a detailed thing I'm asking for, where, I don't know if that is possible. You see, my point here is to say the funds that the people get received from RALS, are they helping to improve the housing in the rural areas? In other words, I'm concerned with standards. Or do we just give out funds and we don't bother about what kind of houses come out of those funds? Because we are talking here of the need to improve the human settlements in the rural areas. We are talking about transforming rural settlements. I think, in my opinion, quality also goes a long way. I know it may not be possible to prescribe exactly, but at least maybe we could have some basic standards that we expect, you know, to come out of the loans that people have obtained from RALS. Now, secondly, yes, I'm also happy about the connection with the NDP, yeah, because we would like to see, you know, that what we are talking about, the plan for 2030, is actually being implemented. We have looked at this, and everybody says 18 years is not a very long time, which means that we should really start now. We don't have to wait until we are close to 2030 to be able to achieve what, for instance, is being envisaged in the development plan. Thirdly, Chairperson, I'm just wondering, you see, I've been trying to look at the figures, the budget. I must say it's taking me quite a long time to follow because the plan is not the usual one. So I would like to find out, for instance, that's a simple question. What percentage, for instance, in the 2011-2012 budget went to the loans? What percentage of your budget went to loans? And what percentage do you envisage will go into loans in the 2012-2013 budget? the partnership with the NGOs. Can you also give us, you know, an example of how you actually work with these NGOs? What I've received here is just a general explanation that you do work with NGOs and that you intend making inroads, more inroads into the NGOs. You actually mentioned the stock fairs and so on and so forth. You have to just give us maybe just one example of an NGO that you work with and how you work with it, and then we'll be able to understand. I think the other area probably doesn't concern Ralph, but you see, I'm trying to see the connection between the funds that you give out and, for instance, the other entities in the human settlement, which look at the quality, the standards, and so on, and including the training, for instance, that is the capacity building. Because in the rural areas, what is really lacked currently is people with the correct skills, you see, yeah. The people with the correct skills to enable those to whom you offer the loans, to enable them to be able to get value for the money that you issue. So as I'm saying, I know it may not necessarily be your area, the question of training, but it seems to me you should also be concerned about this concern that we have as to how do we really manage to have enough people in the rural areas who will be able to that the people who build these houses in the rural areas from the loans that they have received from RALF do get value for their money. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, and just apologies for being late. I was engaged in the other meeting. You see, the problem that I have with this fund is that often they are being mandated to offer financial relief to beneficiaries, and it doesn't always get to those beneficiaries. Now, I would like to find out, just to add on what Honorable Mamjove said, how many loans have you offered? How many beneficiaries have been reached by this loan? Because these loans or these funds are always there to assist the people, but often they don't get to those people. A classical example is the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant, which is not spent. So I want to believe that this is not the case with RALF, that you are making sure that you get the beneficiaries to benefit from these loans. So if we can get just a brief on saying how far are you doing in terms of how many loans have you issued, how many beneficiaries have you reached over the past financial year. The second one is the issue of your monthly income on your slide, page 2. I hope to believe that this would be the gap market. And frankly, in rural areas, you don't have the gap market. You've got the poorest of the poor. So how are you doing to make sure that you cater for the market, for the target market? Because if you look at this maximum 9,008 and 3,005, it's your typical urban gap market that we are struggling to get to. So don't you think that you should go a little bit lower in terms of the rural areas? Because at some point you're talking of farm workers, you're talking of, you know, seasonal workers who might not necessarily be earning this amount of money. And I think it might also help you to mitigate, on page 3, the effects of RALF, because of you are saying you having high rejection on applications and bad debt and whatever. Maybe the thing is that the target market that you are targeting is not the correct one, and can you have a look at that? The third one is the issue of, I see you here, you are linking the state of the nation in terms of infrastructure and spatial restructuring. How are you doing in terms of making sure that the backlog of rural infrastructure is being addressed? Do you offer loans for infrastructure, or how are you assisting in that process? Because we've got a massive backlog of rural infrastructure.
The other one already I've asked about the mitigation of this effect on RALF. What are you doing to mitigate this effect that you have listed in page 3? Lastly, is on page 5, is the issue of identification of community-based organizations. And there I think Mam Jove asked a very relevant question. Can you just give us a briefing on how are you working with them? Have you got very good working examples, you know, to help work with self-help organizations? And the other one linked to that is the issue of partnership with employee organizations. What is the status quo there? Are we making progress? Are the employee organizations coming on board in recognizing this? Because of, I believe RALF can be one of those funds that we can use for people to start to learn to take responsibility in building houses rather than relying on handouts from government. So how are we using it to make sure that people understand the bigger picture of what we want to do with this fund? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pesin. I also have a question on the very same slide, the very first one that Mam Jome has just mentioned. I was just looking at this house, because if I look it very well, I think it's built closer to a roundabout. Then they came a question in my mind: how much do you give the people? Let's say for a person who's earning 3,500, how much do you give that particular person a loan to build a house in rural area? Another one. I would like to know, how do you monitor the money that you give people for building houses, not to that money to be utilized for something else? How do you monitor it? You talk of high rejection. What causes it? And with the board, how long is the term of a board? Because when I look there, there are people, there is a person who has been there from 1998. Maybe it has been renewed, her name has been renewed, I don't know. With the 49.5 million, I've been thinking of the rejection. Then you have this 49.5. Are the people, are they maybe rejected because the money is no longer there? Or what is the problem? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I apologize to accumulate. I was engaged right here in Parliament. It's a disadvantage maybe to ask, to be the last one to ask some questions. Because, so most of the questions have been asked, Chairperson. I don't want to waste time. I just want to get clarity. When you talk that you are engaging provincial government and local government, the interaction, I just want to be clarified, or how often do you train the provincial government and local government? How often do you conduct the training? And then again, you talk on, same on page 4, you talk of, you focus on provinces where RALF has potential to increase lending. Can you just give us a breakdown of those provinces? And then I think it's enough, because most of the questions will be asked. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fathers, I think and the Umis and Gomez will respond to this one, governance issues. I did not understand the presentation on this matter because I was just it's a misrepresentation, but seemingly the board decided not to fill the vacancies. I'm not sure whether Mr. Faraz was saying so. For the reasons that to me are not clear. Because I want to check whose responsibility or discretion to make sure that the board is in full complement. Is it not the department? Is it a discretional aspect to buy the board itself by that entity? So I want to check on that. Because if you recall, the president is busy with these with the review of these public entities. So if we don't have standardized processes, it means we're going to have a problem. So I just wanted to check on that. And then the other issue is about on page 10, on the statement of financial performance, there's a consulting fee there, general provisions for 1.5 million on voucher program. What type of consultation is this? When was this consultation started? How far are we with this consultation? How much has been paid? How much is outstanding? And can we get exactly what is this consultation about? What is it? What are you doing? What you really at this cost for me? I don't believe it. What how come does this happened to come to this issue area. And then the other issue I want to raise is on the voucher scheme, because in our understanding there has been an agreement to pilot this in the Eastern Cape. And in my belief is that the province has to budget for this. I don't think it's a responsibility of the national department, because what could be happen on this matter is the department, provincial department, to ensure that they are budgeting for this, and then the national department provides that funding. So, Ural, there's this. I think we need to come back after. During the report, because this 49 million for recapitalization, we need to come back and present details, a breakdown of this this amount. So, you also raised an issue of counselor training. This matter has been always coming front, that in fact, as the committee, we have been raising that the department has to make sure that we have one institution that is going to be responsible for training. So there has to be a coordination of this training. We want to know what steps have been taken to make sure that, because each and every human settlement institution has got training. Yes, they have got to provide that training, but how do you ensure that there's coordination of that training to
make sure that there's no duplication. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just one more question
before they answer. Yeah. On slide 10, too, you reminded me when you talked about the consultation fees. Because I only noticed that the last item. Yeah, it just says that chairperson other administrative issues, other administrative
what cost
expenses. To me, you see, when you look at the figures generally in that slide, they are not very big, but the consultation, the other administration are quite high. But I would like them to unpack that other administration issues, precisely for the reason that at first I thought maybe it includes staff costs and so on, but to find that there is a special item there for staff costs. The staff costs are identified there separately. So then one asks the question, what could be these other administrative expenses that amount to that figure that we put there for what? For
2012. Yeah, March 2012. Mike. Hi. In terms of number of meetings, the board, full board meets 4 times a year. They are allowed, in terms of their rules, to ask for additional meetings if they so require. And each of the subcommittees meet before the board meeting, so they also have 4 meetings. External, internal auditors. The external auditors have been on board now for 4 years. So we're looking at possible replacement next year. We are also querying the size of their fees, so they may be replaced earlier than that. Internal auditors have been around for a number of years. Again, they'll be going out on for tenders shortly. I'm not sure exactly how long they have been, but it has been a while. The question was asked about the decline in expenses over budget this year. The biggest decline in salaries was the chief operating officer wasn't reappointed when Mr. Fakazi was promoted to chief executive. And the chief financial officer resigned, so it was only a part of the year there was a chief financial officer on board. It's the main reason why the salary costs are down. The consulting fees, Mr. Fakazi, could you answer that one?
Yeah, on consulting fees, we had budgeted for verification of information that is submitted by clients, I mean, to us. So we appointed our internal auditors to do that verification, but it looked like we had over budgeted, so the actual costs were less than what we had budgeted for.
I just want to do a bit of a follow up, because if you begin to go forward to your forecast March 2012 and then you've got March 2013, those figures seem to be increasing. Now, if you've over budgeted, then you've the actual is under. Now you're increasing beyond that other again. Can we just understand that? It doesn't seem to if your capacity is reducing. It's just spend the money. I think that's really the question, and it's scary. If you look at those figures there.
I think if we look at the put the chief operating officer position on hold. However, we're not quite sure what's happening with the voucher program. If that does come in, we will need to fill that position. We don't want to go over the budget.
On the consulting fees, we're trying to identify a lot of community-based organisations. To be blunt, we don't know what's out there. We don't know who the community-based organisations are. We're looking at some sort of consulting program to actually identify what community-based organisations are out there. We can talk what they are, stock fills, what sort of stock fills, what size, what are the needs, what are the abilities to then to actually absorb funds from us. There's a lot of research that needs to go into that, and we are budgeting to do consulting in that, and also we're budgeting to do more in-depth impact analysis to see what is happening with the end-user loans. So there's a lot of questions about those, and we would like to make sure that we're getting the right impact in the right areas, so we're going to be doing more consulting there. And again, because it's such a different field, you know, urban is easy, it's more areas to cover, it's more things to research. Rural, they're vast areas that people need to cover. We think they're going to, are they going to end up doing desktop research? Are they actually going to get in cars and travel all over the country? It's a very difficult thing to budget that sort of consulting at this stage. We'd rather over-budget it and then say, well, we've managed to save some money, which if our money is saved, it's not money that's simply going back to Treasury, is unspent. It's money that can then be used for additional loans. So we're not, as an organisation, we don't see an underspend as bad as a lack of delivery. It almost helps us increase our delivery capacity.
Just want clarity in the way you've got this. You know, you talk about March 2012 and March 2013. Now, March 2012 is kind of just about behind us now. What years are we talking about here? We're talking about forecasts, but March 2012 is come and gone just about.
In fact, we're talking about 2013. The first sentence talks about 2013 going forward. But what we said is that in the current financial year, we had over budgeted in terms of consulting fees because of that verification project, where I said, our internal auditors ended up charging us less. But then going forward, I think the huge portion of the consulting fees, we had made a provision of 1.5 million to cater as a contingency, to cater for the voucher program, because our fear is that when RAF is expected to play a role in terms of supporting implementation of the voucher program, we don't want to be caught napping. So we had made a provision of about 1.5 million in consulting fees, for that purpose. But as you can see, if you compare to what was budgeted for March, by March 2012, it goes down from 3.3 million to about 2.2 million. And the last proportion of that 2.2 million actually caters, for the voucher program, which has been expected to play a role in the implementation of the voucher program. And then other projects basically will pertain to identifying, CBOs, research work that has to be done there. So that will be the difference from 3.3 in the current financial year that is ending March 2012, which was basically budgeted for 3.3. And then going down to 2.2 in the next financial year, 2012-2013.
Just a quick follow-up on this voucher system. I think it's quite a very important one. What is your rollout plan, and how do you plan to phase it out?
Regarding the cover of the presentation, whether that house, Yeah, the question was whether well funded, I mean, that, the house that is on the cover there, this one. In fact, when we came in, that house was already there. But what RAF has financed is the purchase of the block that you see there on the yard. So we cannot really claim credit in terms of the house that already exists. The borrower had actually accessed finance from one of our intermediaries to purchase those blocks, and the plan was to build, I mean, a new house in the household. Okay, yeah. And then I think there's a question in terms of, other than just providing funds, what else are we doing basically to help the rural households to build quality houses? Once RAF has, we have what we call building advice handbook that we produce and make available to our intermediaries and ask our intermediaries to hand the copy of the building advice handbook to the borrower for free. In that handbook, there is a chapter on budgeting so that we can help the households to understand the importance of family budgeting, which is very critical in terms of them accessing loans. But importantly, there is also advice in terms of how to avoid common building, you know, problems, how to structure, you know, the contract for a local builder, and basically looking at the foundations, you know, basically at a very, very, very low level, because we know that people hire local builders to build houses for themselves. So the extent to which we can go is to build capacity for households to manage building process for themselves, is to hand them the building advice handbook. It gets produced in English, in isiZulu, catering for Ngoyi languages, and isiTswana, catering for Sotho languages. And then in terms of working with the CBOs, what are we doing in that regard? I think that it has been a great challenge for us to identify community-based organizations, and we are trying to intensify our efforts in that regard. In the last financial year, we were able to identify a stock fed just outside of Bloemfontein, which is accessing funding from RAF for its members. It has about 35 members. What we find basically is that we need to mitigate risk, you know, for RAF and to help them really to achieve their development, you know, goals. We feel that we really need to build capacity. So what we are doing needs analysis, because what we noticed is we imagine in terms of group dynamics, once you draw in money in a group of people, I mean, there could be other problems that could arise. So the aspect of dispute resolution, so they have to be sort of assisted in terms of understanding how they need to settle disputes among themselves. But also we are handing money to the Stockfeld and cooperative. Probably amount of money is much bigger than any amount that they've ever handled. So in terms of financial management, you need to assist them also to be able to handle, I mean, finances. So those are some of the interventions that we are packaging together with, I mean, the loan to these type of entities. But I must be honest, as we have indicated, we haven't worked much in the past with these type of entities. So the research that we'll be doing in terms of identifying the CBOs or alternative business channels that we can work with, in that process as well, we have to identify the needs in terms of what else we need to do to improve their capacity to give us impact. And Honorable Makhalapa, I think, asked a question in terms of how many loans, for example, this year we have granted. I think at the end of the first three quarters of the year, we had disbursed the number of loans, 34,500. In January, I think there was 4,600. So we are still well below in terms of our targeted number of loans of 46,000 by the end of the financial year. But we are hoping that come the end of the financial year will be very close, or we might just exceed, I mean, the target. That's where we are in the current financial year. Okay.
One of the areas that I've picked up since I joined the organization is we're sitting with a capital base of around 300 million. If you look at the intermediaries that we've helped set up over the years, they're sitting at dispersing loans of somewhere around 3 billion. So effectively, we're getting a 10 times return on the money we put out there. We our money has been used for around 46,000 loans this year. The total loans that have been caused by the Ralph work over the years that have been issued this year is probably closer to 50,000 or 60,000, but not at least, and not using government funds for that because of the ripple effect of Ralph having set up this rural housing finance. So I think the impact is far greater than the actual numbers that we can actually give out.
The question also from Honorable Mahlaba in terms of the gap market in rural areas. I think we need to acknowledge that in rural areas you have people like teachers, nurses, you know, police officers probably who are in that market, I would say bracket, just above, I mean just below or sometimes above 9,800, who decide out of their own choice to build on communal land, rather than move to the nearby towns or cities and commute back to work in rural areas. There's a market that you want to assist to access finance so they can build decent houses, bigger houses on communal land. It's part of rural development. Those people will never or will not be able to access mortgage finance. So they either will use their own savings or they'll have to actually access, I mean, loan finance that can actually assist them to quicker build bigger houses. That is our target market. That's why we actually motivated for the increase of the upper limit from 7,500 to 9,800, which was approved in the last financial year. But I think in terms of looking at the lowest end of the market, that market segment has not been offered just because Ralph has increased the upper limit. 60% of our loans still have to go to people actually with income of 3,500 and less. I think consistently over years that has been achieved, but I must concede that in the current financial year and in the recent financial year, affordability levels have been very low even in that market. So that's why we have seen a situation where we achieved 53% of the loans going to the target market. We are still very proud because it's still the majority of loans being accessed by people in the lowest end of the market. So I think we are playing a big role in that regard. With regard to the status of partnership with employee organizations, I mean, 2 weeks ago when we were here, I indicated that we have taken a step. We have identified what does one union that we want to work with their trust in terms of targeting to assist their members. The meeting is in the pipeline. But what we will be doing, we'll not be looking just at one sector, but we wanted to start, I mean, somewhere, and then go to other sectors. But what was attractive for us with this sector is that many of its members basically are professionals in our target market, you know. So we think we need to talk to them directly. But importantly, we share the same objective with the union in terms of promoting development, you know, so that people can access finance and build houses while they are working. Because the experience has been that some people actually would not afford, I mean, take loans to build decent houses until they retire, and then they take part of their lump sum and build, I mean, bigger houses. So once we enable that access, that they access finance while they are still working, we're going to be approaching other sector organizations as well. And I think continuously going forward, we'll be reporting back to the department and the committee in terms of what we are achieving in that regard. I think there is a question from Honorable Sotsibo about the monitoring. How are we monitoring that the loans that we use for housing? What happens on a monthly basis, our intermediaries submit housing impact monitoring reports to us, because when a borrower makes an application for a loan, the question is asked, it's provided for in the application form where they will indicate what they use money for, housing, education, and so on. Those application forms and they get tallied, and then monthly then you get reports. But what you do over and above that, we go as a RAF team to the field basically to check whether that money was used for housing. Together in the department, I mean, currently they are also doing independent verification visits. They select, I mean, randomly borrowers who have accessed RAF funding. And then what we have been doing in the past has been that maybe 3 years or so, and then we basically get a bigger sample and get an independent service provider to conduct impact survey in terms of what we have achieved. But as I've indicated, that in the next financial year, we are building internal capacity so that we can continuously, not on ad hoc basis, you know, as part of our business, we'll have to have capacity that we utilize to monitor on an ongoing basis that the funds are used, I mean, for housing. We think that will be important because it will send a message to our intermediaries that we are serious about impact because we are government-owned and we have to report about our impact also in terms of the auditing process. And then there's a question on governance. I think it comes from the Honorable Chairperson. Let me just clarify, probably we might not have been very clear during our presentation. It was not the board that decided to unilaterally reduce the number of directors. When we were here in October last year to present our annual report, this committee raised its concern that our board was too big. If we had 11 non-executive directors and 11 staff members, sort of 1-to-1 ratio. So when the former directors, I mean, left, so there were vacancies. And then at the AGM, annual general meeting, at which the members that are appointed by the minister sit, actually that's where the appointment of directors, I mean, is made. So that's when that decision was taken, that because the articles of association of SALF provide for a minimum of 3 directors, non-executive directors, and we already have 7 after the resignation of the directors who had left. So 7 is an ideal number of directors that we can retain so that we do not appoint new directors and then grow the size of the board again. You know, so we took that opportunity in that context. So it wasn't the board that took that decision. And then there is a question from Honorable Mashishi in terms of our provincial engagement. How often, in terms of how often? Probably say, Honorable Member, that we do not do that as often as we should. You know, we do engage with the provinces mainly around identifying of opportunities where we can play, you know, some role, like identifying where service sites have been delivered. It's sort of more ad hoc. We have had formal communication to all provinces. We have had feedback from some provinces. We have had subsequent engagement with them directly, you know, to get that information. So, but it's not like in a structured way that we say every month. So, but we need to improve going forward, and we hope that when there is information and there is activity in an intense way in terms of, you know, marketing opportunities in identified areas, so probably we'll be having more structured and more regular engagement. And then in terms of your question, Honourable Member, as to Ralph saying we want to lend more in provinces where we currently have less lending. Those provinces are mainly Free State, Northern Cape and Limpopo. I'm happy to share with the board that the last credit meeting in this month, the credit committee approved a facility for a trust, Modigo Finance Trust, which is owned by Mining Development Agency, MDA, and it operates in Puta de Chava. So we're assisting them to offer a housing loan product in Puta de Chava. It's a pilot at this phase, but their expansion plan, they want to go cover the whole of Free State and part of Northern KwaZulu-Natal, mainly areas that have been known as labor sending areas, you know, to the mining companies. So we'll have more presence in the Free State, rather, we hope, going forward.
We asked a question around why the rejections are increasing. What appears to be happening is that the target market, I suppose, for our intermediaries is starting to get saturated. They are becoming over-indebted. I did some research over the past week, and I was looking at African banks' financial results. The average installment that they accept and for their customers is for up to 40% of the person's net income. The average they're rejecting is somewhere people who are actually applying for additional finance and they've already got 70% of their income going on financial installments. I mean, 70% of installments for people in rural areas, when you consider what they need to spend on transport, is just there is no way those people can or should be getting extra finance. So that is probably the biggest reason for rejections at the moment, is over-indebtedness of the potential borrowers.
Honourable Chairperson, just the last question. There was a question from Mr. Makhalaba in terms of financing infrastructure development. I think I need just to explain that we do not really directly fund infrastructure development. That's way above our weight, you know. But I think the benefit for us is that when people get access, you know, to services like water in the yard, and then they need finance maybe to connect into water, I mean, into their, I mean, houses, running water in the house, septic tanks and so on, electricity to chew their house and so on. So we are there standing ready to provide finance for them to enable them to enjoy the benefits, you know, of having access to services in their house, but not infrastructure development as such.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think most of the governance questions have been answered, save for the one which came from Honourable Sosibo with reference to the term of office of the board, as this institution is a Section 21 in terms of the Companies Act. It has members whom we may regard as shareholders, and it has the board, which is appointed by the shareholders. Now, members are normally appointed by the minister, and they play a very inactive role except in annual general meetings. The board is the one which is playing a very active role. Now, in terms of their articles, the articles of association of this company, the board are eligible on an open-ended basis. Now, we needed to alter the articles of association to be in line with government policy, that a board member can only serve for 2 terms of 3 years. But in the light of the fact that we are busy with the DFI review, we felt altering the articles of association now, whilst we are changing the structure of the companies, it's an exercise which will not, you know, yield the results which we want. So we said, let's leave things as they are until we have achieved the amalgamation of the 3 institutions. Now, RALF, NHFC, and NATURE do not have an enabling legislation which establishes them. They were all established in terms of the Companies Act. So each one is having its own unique articles of association. That is why when you look at NHFC board, you will find people who have been there for more than 2 terms. In the same way with NATURE. But that is going to change as soon as we pass the legislation, which will bring all the 3 institutions together. So for now, we are just leaving the status quo as it is. The other question, I think Mr. Falazi have answered, the issue of deciding not to fill the vacancy in the board. The issue of training of councillors, which was raised by the chairperson, is done by our capacities section in the department. RALF is merely assisting our capacities section in the department with training of councillors in rural areas, because they are having a rural outreach Maybe that's the reason why they are also involved in assisting. But the champions for training, it's still the Department of Human Settlements. Now, the chair also alluded to the fact that training must be consolidated. We are busy with that. We know that NHGRC is involved with training of contractors. NHGRC is also involved with training of contractors. We are bringing all those training under uniformity. There are consultations, there are negotiations taking place that our training approach should be unified. We shouldn't be having separate entities doing a training. Then the last question, I think it came from Honorable Kalaba on the issue of the voucher scheme. Now, the voucher scheme, as you know, all members, is that it uses the rural subsidy, which is provided by provinces. Ralph was just going to assist in facilitating through a voucher, facilitating this subsidy to the beneficiaries through a voucher. But now, any decision which involves funding from subsidy, it needs MINMEC, it needs technical MINMEC. Now, Ralph, I would say, had piloted the role and the policy together with our policy section. Let me just indicate now that the finalized policy is now being presented to MINMEC. I think the next coming MINMEC will be able to table the finalized policy. Once MINMEC approves that, we know that there is a pilot in Eastern Cape which is ready to roll out. So we cannot at this current stage say when will be the rollout, but it seems Eastern Cape has taken decisions, the MEC has taken decision, and probably some funding has been allocated for the voucher in Eastern Cape, but we cannot say it will roll out, when it's going to roll out, until MINMEC take a decision in the next coming MINMEC. Thank you, Chair.
I think we have come. Is there anything that you have left, Mr. Farrell? I don't think so.
No, there's nothing, whatever, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just forget to ask that one of the media on African languages. I just checked that. I see here that we have left the page. Can you just clarify?
I think for me, this question about the intermediaries and the decline there is quite a worrying thing. And I want to know, you're talking about being more caring and you know, as you do that and you go out to deal with people in the rural areas, as I'm understanding you're saying, you'll adopt a manual approach to this. What is your capacity to be able to do that? Because you actually operate with a very small staff. I'd just like to know what that is.
Yeah, I'll answer you. We're talking about the intermediaries who have very minimal systems. I think, yes, we do have a small staff. We have got, if you look at our financial statements, we do make a good profit every year. As we identify the needs there, we will look at increasing our staff numbers with possibly some interns with accounting background to assist them with those manual systems that they need to have, and we'll design a system for the community-based intermediaries to assist them with that and provide a lot of training on that. I'll be going to a livestock association in the next month to actually see what their current systems are, because they currently receive, the one I'm going to is in KZN, they receive money from the KZN Department of Agriculture, which they have to account for, and they've got manual systems that they use for that. I'm going to be looking and seeing what they've got and get an understanding of how that works, so that I can get a feeling for what we need to put into these, into community-based organizations, so we've got an understanding there. And from there, we can then work out what sort of staffing we might need to get.
Very briefly, on the issue of 50 pages being left out, that's not intentional. We've asked our marketing people basically to talk to provinces so that they identify it. I mean, available newspapers that are in these local languages. So I think we were not able to get some feedback in Limpopo, but certainly if the honorable member knows a newspaper in Limpopo that is in Sepedi, I would be grateful to get the name. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fagas and honorable members. Can we just say we are appreciating the report from Ralph, and we are looking forward on working together. But this voucher scheme it's our interest, but we are very much impressed if the province of the Eastern Cape is taking that initiative. I think it's a breakthrough, because we want to see things happening. I don't think Minmec will reverse the fund. If the policy is there, I don't think there won't be any problems. Can we just thank you very much, and then you are released, but you can just have tea, and you don't leave, you listen to others today. Don't run away. And then we're going to give the opportunity to HDA. By the time they are busy setting themselves up. NHFC, ufigemfa. I want to ufigemfa NHFC. And you look at the hang out. This phone is a lesson. HDA. The people who were at the doorstep when we were opening, it was rough. Then the second group, it was HDA. So you are the last one. Last in. Thank you very much. Over to you, HDA.
Thank you.
By 12 o'clock, we'll try to make sure that we finish our business. So we've got a limited time, and then I think NHFC and NASAM have been grilling NHFC. I think this is the third or not the fourth time. Okay, HDA.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. If I can start by introducing the team again, just so that everybody is aware of who they are, because they will be answering some of the questions that might come from the Portfolio Committee. Immediately on my left is Roxana Muller, who is our CFO. To her left is Joseph Leshabani, who is the Manager of Intergovernmental Relations.
Next to him is Odette Crofton, who is responsible for projects and programs. Next to her is Nellie Lester, who is now general manager for land acquisition management. And next to her is Rashida Issel, who is our manager of corporate services. Sitting behind are two people in support. Right at the back there is Kate Shand, who is in communications, and Zinhle Mabanjwa, who is from corporate intergovernmental relations. We'll be talking about this strategic plan going forward. You have the documents, the full plan, and the presentation, the slide presentation. Firstly, just to talk about our key achievements. We have operated with our grant and other funds which are provided, and this will be our third year concluding now, going into the fourth year. We have achieved clean audits. We have formalized 9 intergovernmental protocols, and 4 further ones are being prepared. We've got something called a medium-term operational plan, which is the operational activity of the implementation protocols. We have identified, being very successful in identifying land and verifying it, and that's not a small operation, Madam Chair. We talked about that at our last meeting, but we have done that, as will come out later on. The big problem is how do you get it from identification to release. There is a joint coordinating committee on state land release that's been established. We've got a policy which we work on with different enterprises, different agencies of state. We are hoping to take transfer in excess of 3,000 hectares. We've reached agreement on the transfer of 105 hectares from Servcon, and we've identified further land with the municipalities. Those are the various achievements. We've got 2 buildings that are awaiting transfer from Servcon in Johannesburg. We have identified 309 transnet properties, and again, we've asked for the transfer, similarly for land by Department of Public Works in Gauteng. We're awaiting approval from the Minister for Northwest land. We are in the process of trying to get land from KZN Public Works. Our internal GIS systems for LAPSIS and NASLI, which essentially is the GIS systems for identifying and planning, and that's working well. We have a draft priority housing development area policy framework, and that's currently being considered by the National Department. We do have funding for Zanabula and the N2, and both projects are performing well. You will get, after this, 2 little videos. We would like to show one, but we don't think we've got the sound facilities available here, but you'll get them on a disc for you to look at your leisure. And we are involved in other projects that are coming on. So essentially on the 2 areas of land acquisition and project development, land identification we're doing well on. Land acquisition is lagging a bit, but we're hopeful that will start to come through. And the project work that we've done, we seem to be doing quite well and be appreciated by the groups that we're working for, the provinces and cities that we're working with. In relation to outcome 8 in particular, there are 2 particular areas of work that we're involved in. The first is the acquisition of 6,250 hectares, and I've talked a bit about that. And then we are working with the National Department and the various provinces where we have these agreements on the upgrading of informal settlement, which will make a contribution to the outcome 8 activity. As we said in our last presentation, where with the department presented on what the various agencies would be doing in relation to the new focus coming out of the State of the Nation address, and at our last discussion with you, we presented what we were doing there. There was a question at that last sitting as to what the extent of state land was, Madam Chair. I did send that through to you. I'm not sure if it's been distributed, but in fact it's quite interesting because state-owned land seems to be about, to the extent that we can achieve and ascertain it, seems to be about 12% of the entire population, state of land, of the geographical area of the country as a whole. That's very interesting because it's quite close to the 13% that was reserved under the 1912
Land Act. So it's quite an interesting comparison there. That's our general organizational structure. We currently have, it comes up a little bit further, we currently have approximately 60, well, we have exactly 60 people, 65 people permanently employed in the HDA staff establishment, but we have 115 people employed right throughout the HDA offices because of what occurs in our various project offices where we employ people on a contract basis related to specific projects. So currently HDA is operating out of four offices, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Nelson Mandela, and Limpopo, or Polokwane, and of the 115 staff, it's approximately half-half in the projects and half in the formal establishment. The next couple of slides just go through what our goals and objectives are. I don't know that it's necessary to deal with them in detail because you've seen this before. They haven't changed dramatically. We put this slide in, Madam Chair, just to give you an indication of the link between what our ultimate impact should be and the various activities and inputs that we have. So if you deal with the actual activities, which are releasing land, acquiring property at the bottom, and then doing projects and establishing protocols, that over a period in the kind of chain that we've linked it, and this really comes out of a document that Treasury has circulated, we hope to be seeing in time the development of housing and human settlements in a well-located land, a contribution to spatial restructuring, and the enhancing of planning capacity in organs of state, as well as project and program management support of the capability of organized or for organs of state. All of those are in embryo in the different activities that we do, and we're really going through the chain to try and get that to be our major output over time. These are the indicators that we have indicated we will be able to achieve over the next over the five-year period. They are a little more modest than they were last year. I remember Honourable Steyn asking that question last time, and he smiled and he said we're reducing our focus. We are intending to identify land and get it released, 4,250 hectares over the next financial year. We are hoping to, we are hoping to get 50 properties, or 5 properties and 50 hectares in our, actually acquired by the HDA as opposed to what we get from the different, on behalf of the different organs of state. Our actual management of land would be 1,000 hectares. The board yesterday approved 500 hectares, the Polokwane. We yesterday at a board meeting provisionally approved the acquisition of 500 hectares in Limpopo, Lepalale. That still has to go through a whole range of activities so to get it into our hands. But nevertheless, we are pursuing that, and we're hoping to release the land that we own, 20% of that, into the development cycle going on next year. We're hoping to support 20 projects and programs. We're wanting to see priority housing developments determine three such determinations, and we're looking for 15 IGR protocols going forward. The next couple of slides really just outline the development of our the framework in which we work. Program one is strategic management, finance, and corporate services, and that lists the areas that we're involved in. Program two looks at land assembly, and again, it looks at the four activities that we're involved in. Program three looks at program technical support services, and again, lists the various areas that we're looking at. The Section 29 projects refers to Zanambula and the M2, and IGR has, again, those four areas of activity. Risks are an important area of activity and increasingly form part of the way in which we look at projects and activities. We have listed there the major risks associated with the different goals. and the mitigating action to try and deal with that. We now have in place the required staff to help us do that on a regular basis in an attempt to avoid the risks that are out there. From an operational budget point of view, just to make 2 points, the one is that obviously there's been the grant. We have kept the staff establishment down in order to operate within the grant, but also to say that we have diversified sources of income so that we now have income coming from the Section 29 projects and the and various provinces where we've reached agreements. These in general are programs with budgets which are aimed at covering costs, so that all of the external programs are ones which are negotiated with the provinces on the basis that we can cover the costs of the activities that we're in. On the issue of the capital budget, there currently is no capital grant allocation directly to us, although we have been talking to the department about proposals. We've asked for, and it's being processed, an amount of $315 million to purchase state-owned land. Otherwise, we would do purchases on the basis of money that's been made available to us by provinces. We have acquired one piece of land on that basis. That's in Bella Bella. We are negotiating a second piece of property for Northwest Province based on money they've given us for Ventersdorp. Where we have savings, we would use that for land purchases, and that's where the money for the 500 hectares that we're considering two pieces of land, one in the Tswane area, one in the Lepalale area, and that would come from savings internal. And with the department, we're working on a comprehensive capital funding land acquisition program. Madam Chair, that's the presentation. If it's not too disturbing, I would like to put some pictures on the board, which will just flow through as we talk. Those will just be slides that will go through. They're all from our project. That's from the N2. That's the TR5. That's N2. N2. Same. Sound facility, we could play you a video, but you'll get that in the pack that we leave.
Thank you very much, Mr. Adler. Emma, can you just interact, and let's keep it short, because I've been studying this, it means we still have to engage with HDA, but we cannot finish engagement with HDA, because I can't tell you, it was all about decide that we will never do anything. Honourable members, honourable comments, honourable Mkhalapa, Mamzobe, thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I must say you are very thorough. And the chair has just been waving this book around. And I must say, I've been trying to actually look at it and deal with some of it, but it needs a bit of time. And certainly, I think what you've done here is to be very transparent in, you know, updating us. So that is very good. I think of concern, you know, without land, and, you know, whenever we get engaged anywhere, it's land, land, land. Now, you have identified what seems to be massive amounts of land that, you know, can be used. What role can we be playing to assist in perhaps doing a push for finance, if that is what is needed here? I don't know what the hold-up is, you know, in being, are you being able to access the funding for the acquisition of the land? And then, you know, coupled with that, the state-owned land, I know we've discussed this many times, but, you know, what sort of money are we looking at for state-owned land? Is that not going to be handed over, surely, you know, and not at any great price? The other thing I would like to put on the table, and that is you've very nicely, and you've again emphasized that you've got very detailed plans here for the N2 and Zanabula, lovely pictures that we're seeing there. When are we going to see Cornubia? I don't know why that is the Cinderella here that has been on the table for such a long time. In some form like this, because my understanding is that we've actually got hold-ups there. So, you know, I would like some comment about that, please. But otherwise, thank you very much for this. We'll certainly get into it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also echo the sentiments of the presentation. But yes, the Bible that you've given us, I think we have to go through. We have to have more engagement with you on that one. I don't think we can condense it today. So we will call you again. At the last page, where you are saying on the capital budget, you are saying there's currently no capital grant allocation confirmed for the HDA for land acquisition for privately owned and SOE. Why is that the case, and what do you think we should do to try and assist this, because of it's not only state-owned land that we are looking at, and I think maybe the answer might be in the Bible you've given us, to say this 12% that you've referred to of the state-owned land, where is it? Is it prime land, or is it just land that is there that we are just acquiring? Because of I'm of a view that if we acquire land, we've got to acquire land that is prime land. And I know that sometimes it might be difficult to acquire that prime land if it's state-owned land, and state-owned entity land. It might be mainly privately owned. And again, I think most of the questions that we might be having might be in the book that you've given us, because of the question was, where is the land? I think you've given us a good presentation the last time where you were showing us the parcels, where they are and how they are. And how far in this acquisition of the 6,250 hectares of land that you need to acquire? But I think we acknowledge your mandate and we understand your mandate. It's quite an important one. All we can do is to try and assist you in terms of funding and making sure that we are unblocking those policy gaps that are there to assist you in doing your work. But I believe you're thorough
explanation might be in the book, and one will have to go through it. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, I was saying, Chairperson, I think the questions are more or less the same, or the comments rather, are more or less the same. But let me say thank you very much for the homework that you have done to find, for us to know that 12% of the land is of the state, 12% of South Africa's land is owned by the state. Am I right?
Yeah.
And as you say, it's really close to the 13%. We need to look at that and see, have we moved any further from 1913, or are we still there, or are we behind 1913? It's a very complex question, and I think sometimes it can be quite depressing, I must say. But now, can you do some more homework? I'm going to do it too, but I think it would help me better. Of this 12% land, how much of it is available for housing? In other words, I think it's referring to what Mr. Mahalapo speaks as prime land, isn't it? Yeah. How much of it is available for housing? And then to express another concern, when I look at some of the pictures, particularly the aerial ones, you know, showing land that is available, for instance, for housing, for human settlement, and also showing some of the informal settlements, you know, where they are located. I look at East London, for instance, because, okay, I fly over East London almost every weekend, and I see the informal settlements, you know, fitted somewhere where perhaps the land was left vacant, maybe for nature, to allow for trees and so on and so forth. One hopes that we will not get to a point where Athens is found itself. When I went to Athens a few years back, there wasn't a single tree in that town. And the Greeks were worried, you know, that in terms of as you call it, atmospheric ventilation and so on, it was creating a problem. And they were now beginning to dig holes in the pavement in order to plant some trees. So I'm just saying, as we speak of the 12%, I think we shouldn't forget, you know, the fact that nature plays a very important role even in our town, providing us with oxygen and taking away that carbon dioxide. That's what the trees do every day, as you know. So can we do the homework of the 12%? How much of it is available for housing? Thank you very much.
Thank you. The last point is on the joint coordinating committee that has been established. Who constitutes that committee? And when do you think the committee can come before the portfolio committee to, with yourself, to come and brief the committee on the progress that has been made in terms of releasing the land that has been already identified, as well as the issue of greening? You know, when we were looking at this picture, all the settlements that have been provided by the state, even if you are flying over, easy to identify. This is a state subsidy development. When are we going to begin to say, during our planning, to ensure that we bring other partners, water affairs, agriculture, please, we are in a planning stage, come and plan it with us, By the time we were busy with the infrastructure, a tree is planted. So that when we the time comes of the project completion, when we are trying, when we are there to open that project, trees are there already. Why should we wait? Because if we wait, it's not going to be easy to come back and plant trees to those projects, development. So I think this is an issue that we need to make sure that we consider it seriously. The issue of ITS with the provinces, of which I believe that the funding for land purchases comes from the provinces. Now, I want to check from, because you are the people who have to be upfront in dealing with this matter, because provinces do budget for land purchases, even the municipalities themselves. But they would opt to use other consultants rather than utilizing the asset that has been there for them, which is HDA. So ithini lento? Yambiyambi ithini? Effort, what is your effort together with the department? But I don't want to put the department on this one, because you have been mandated. It is your mandate. How do we ensure, would you make sure that you convince these provinces as well as the municipalities not to utilize the other consultants in respect of this process? I don't know how far you're going to convince the provinces in terms, and the municipalities in terms of moratorium in the selling of the state land. So I think those are the issues that I wanted to raise, I think.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll ask some of my team to respond in some areas. Let me first take up the issue of the Bible. I'm surprised that that's not what you get from everybody, and if not, then maybe we're getting wrong advice from what we should be producing. But, I mean, the Bible essentially is divided into two areas, or maybe three. The one is the overall strategy, which is where, my view, you should be looking at. The rest is a very detailed annual and quarterly breakdown, which we have included. But that would really be the kind of management work.
We are not criticizing you. In fact, we are commending.
Okay.
We are commending you. It's not a criticism.
Fine. Thank you.
We are very much appreciating this, because when we have our time, we have to look at these issues, so that when we engage with yourself in future, at least we have got a full information. Not a criticism.
Okay. Well, then if I can just indicate that the three sections are the overall strategic activity, the second would be the very detailed annual performance plans, and then the budget, and those would be the three areas. You know, we actually had a very robust discussion with the department this week on precisely these issues, because I think the issues that you raised, because they obviously are becoming the crucial points of us being, or of our success. And it really does relate to the acquisition of land in particular. And I think that what was raised in that conversation was very valid comment, and I would even say fraternal criticism about the fact that we haven't done some of the things that we needed to have done a little more quickly than we should have. You can divide the land issue into two particular areas. One is what's going to happen with state, or three areas: state-owned land, SOE-owned land, and privately owned land. And because of the difficulties associated with the second two, SOE land and private land, which I'll come to, we've been focusing on state-owned land. And there, our major focus has been to say, what what land is available, where is it located, and let's try and get it into the development cycle. And we've been, as I've said, and as I think the reports show, quite good at identifying the land, but then it goes into a process which hasn't yet seen the light of day. And part of that's because of problems in other departments or whatever, because essentially we have to go to the custodian department, be it rural development or public works or whatever it is, and get them to approve. And it has turned out to be a long process. And perhaps the key to that, and there have been changes there, there have been changes about ministers, there have been changes about DG level, and changes below that. So there have been a range of reasons which are probably not acceptable in the sense that everybody just wants the land to be out. But perhaps, and I'm not asking Molly to respond because she's too new in the job to do this, but perhaps the way to deal with this now is to say, okay, let's focus on X amount of land, having negotiated this with the provinces and the cities, to say, we want in the next 12 months these particular pieces of land, and everybody then just focuses on that. So it becomes a fairly direct approach as opposed to a scattergun approach, which is to some extent what we've been doing. It's been a little more dispersed, and or maybe the focus will help bring that to bear. So that's the situation with state-owned land. To the extent that we've done it, we've been engaging with departments, it doesn't cost money in the main. There is some budget requirement for management costs, transfer costs, those kind of things, but not for the actual land itself. When it comes to SOE-owned land, there have been considerable negotiations with some of the parastatals, in particular Transnet, and more recently with Denel. The department has been very helpful in facilitating those negotiations, and within the departmental grants, and perhaps the department can comment on that, but there is now discussion about provision for funding for those particular pieces of land. So again, there's now a focus, there's a discussion, in particular, I mentioned the $315 million that has been specifically requested, and there is discussions going on with the three parties, the department, ourselves, sometimes four parties, the requiring or requesting provincial or local authority, and the holder of the land, be it Denel or Transnet. But there is an outstanding piece of work there, which we have not been delivering yet, which relates to a policy on how you deal with state-owned land, because the state-owned enterprises are generally saying they need to leverage their balance sheets to bring down their debt. So they want to use their land to bring down their debt, and they have actually a cabinet mandate to do that. So we are in the process of developing, and we will do it now very rapidly, a policy which will come forward for discussion. So that's what state-owned enterprises. There is a particular focus on a couple of pieces of land. There is a discussion with the Department of Support on trying to find those particular pieces of land, and that will come through. And then privately owned land, we've been predominantly working with the other two areas, but where we have the opportunity for privately owned land, we take it up where it's relevant and there is internal funding available at this point in time, and as we've indicated, the board made a decision at a meeting yesterday on that. So the land issue is increasingly foremost in our mind, and we'll be taking those kind of directions, a focused approach, working through with the department and the provinces and the cities about a specific program, and hopefully we'll be able to present that to you in more detail in the not too distant future. Can I ask Joe just to deal? Let me deal with one last thing on land, and then ask Joe to deal with the two IGR questions that came up. On the question of provincially owned, of money coming from provinces, we negotiate that. They come to us. They have in two cases come to us and said, "We want you to. We know what land we want. We would prefer you to negotiate the price." We've had two different situations, one where we've taken ownership of the land at their request. In other situations, we have negotiated on behalf of the local authority. So there are two scenarios there on that one. But Joe, can you just take up the question of the use of consultants and the JCC?
Perhaps it's important to confirm that the JCC, which is the Joint Coordinating Committee, is a decision of ministers who established that committee at the point when they were signing the delivery agreement. The JCC consists of the Department Human Settlements, the Department Public Works, the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, as well as the Department Public Enterprises. The agency is the creature of the department and therefore it participates in that. Let me confirm, Madam Chair, that the focus of the JCC has been to address exactly the concerns that the members have raised, to say outcome 8, priority 6 to, among other things, ensure the release of 6250 hectares of state land for housing purposes. Where is that land? What can it be used for? Who currently holds it? What needs to be done to release that land? When can it be available? And Madam Chair, it is encouraging to note that there have been joint inspections of these properties that have been identified. Allow me, Madam Chair, to make an analogy, and that analogy, I pray it will not bring any offense. As a young man, before I got married, in the school, in the church, in sports, you look around and you see this beautiful person. And you lay claim to say, I think I have a future here. Only to find that, no, that person is committed to the other. As they say elsewhere, Madam Chair, she is spoken for. And therefore, I have no claim. What we found, Madam Chair, in this JCC is that, yes, we may look at a piece of land, well-located land, currently vacant, and we say, this land belongs to government, and government wants to release land for housing, therefore this is the one. When you step closer, Madam Chair, it's proven that that land is spoken for. There are prior commitments that have been made on that land. The case in point, Madam Chair, just a simple example. Depending if members know Gauteng, if you drive from Johannesburg towards Pretoria, you pass Midrand. In Midrand, you will meet the Development Bank of South Africa. Next to it is a very large piece of land that is vacant. That piece of land, Madam Chair, talk to any town planner, any developer. We are all licking our lips. It's a good piece of land. We can do wonderful things. When we engage with the Department of Public Works, they confirmed that indeed the government has already committed that land to house the African Parliament. So all these things may take a long time to realize, but it is committed. I'm raising this example, Madam Chair, because the other question relates to availability in terms of state land. It may be there, it may be vacant, it may be unused, but it is committed. And the state land administration laws are such that you first would have to undo the commitment where possible before you then reappropriate that land. Madam Chair, it is, I can say, for no lack of effort, but rather the intertwined, and ironically, Madam Chair, that system is so integrated that it's not just possible to simply just dump into it and extract land. It is so integrated that across the board, some of the land is committed to the very government priorities that we are pursuing, education, health. So it's integrated, Madam Chair. And what I would put forward from the point of view of the JCC is, Madam Chair, the reality, that reality one, but also the fact that there is commitment. We sit with those officials. We visited each of the parcels, many of the parcels that have been identified. And as the CEO pointed out, we have a reason to accept that some 3,000 hectares of land should be coming forward in the next few months. But that's an outcome of a process, Madam Chair, that, as I've outlined, it's in my view, Madam Chair, it's a good process. That means it is not just easy to just take that land. I think government should be, it's a system, and therefore the checks and balances are there. And we are frustrated, let me say, Madam Chair, but that is the reality that we have to then work in a compliant manner to secure that. Having said, Madam Chair, I'm sure the JCC, under the leadership of the department, will be more than happy to brief the committee on its workings. Let me also perhaps deal with the question of the provinces and the protocols. In the same way, Madam Chair, the engagements with provinces have proven to us that much as there are shared mandates, we are learning of these concurrent mandates between spheres of government, it is not simply a matter of just taking the mandate from a province and saying HDA will do this. These are negotiated intricately at that. And the good thing is that many provinces, in fact, so far all the provinces are busy considering the protocols with the agency. Provinces have to reorganize themselves. Others have already, for years, had capability to deal with land assembly. And therefore, they are having to make organizational choices about if we sign the protocol with the agency, what happens to our people, the unit, in some cases, the chief directorate, with a lot of people, what happens to those people? What work will they do? And therefore, that is why HODs have been considering the implications to say, do they move those people to us? Do they reassign them? Do they... So there's very serious considerations on the table currently. Madam Chair, I accept that, indeed, the provinces do see a win-win arrangement with the agency. They don't have to have that headache. It will be the agency that delivers on set targets, and we see that in provinces where we've already signed the protocols. Use consultants, Madam Chair, as not so much to buy land. My understanding is that they engage services of consultants to attend to these specialist inquiries, geotech, environmental, etc., 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 which ordinarily even the agency would have to do that. The agency cannot assemble all that capacity in-house because you need it at different times and so forth. It's a question, Madam Chair, of what is the capacity you need to do certain things. But having said that,
I am certain, Madam Chair, that we will be concluding protocols with the provinces in pretty much, I think, in the next 6 months. Let me just say, that is my projection, given the negotiations that are currently underway with provinces. All provinces are keen to conclude protocols. The question is the implications upon them, and they're there to take responsibility to assess those implications going forward. And I don't envisage any, it's not a policy diversion, it's just rather how does that come to bear on their own system, their procedures, and so forth. Similarly, Madam Chair, the municipalities that are recipients of the USDG, they can also conclude protocols with us. We have not pursued the moratorium on the sale of municipal land. Let's be upfront about that. We have not pursued that. The department has gently reminded us that that's a matter we need to pursue. We'll have to put a specific program and approach around that going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A couple more. Can I just ask that to talk about Canubia and greening? And time problems, so you can make it short.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to Canubia, two parts. Firstly, technically, the project has been delayed because the town planning and the framework design of the project had to be redone because of the new airport and the noise contour lines, which were in the area where the housing was to be built. So the whole layout had to be redesigned to accommodate the impact of the noise contour lines, which would have had health and safety issues on families living there should the housing have been built there. So the project largely is in the town planning approval process within the metro, which is quite an intense process, but it's within that process. It's been redesigned and it's in the town planning component. There are two phases currently in the project. The phase 1A infrastructure works is being done there, and there is a process around the housing in the pilot phase, and work has started on a phase B, which is more town planning and infrastructure work than housing work at this point in time. So there is some progress, but the biggest delay in the project is around the town planning and the replanning that had to be done because of the airport. Then my second part, in terms of HDA's role, we are currently in discussions with the Etiquini Metro around specifically defining what role will HDA play in the project and what support will we provide to the project. Once that is clear, then it will be clear exactly what role we play in facilitating the implementation. Largely at this point, it's being driven and run by the Etiquini Metro. We assist and participate in the various structures, but we need to have a much tighter defined role, which we are busy negotiating as part of the protocol, and obviously the link to the province and national in that protocol is quite critical, so that to make the project a success, all three spheres need to be aligned and clear, and the roles of the spheres in the project specifically needs to be very clear. That process takes a while to negotiate, but once that is sorted, and we've seen that in Zanamvula and N2, once the role players are clear and the roles are defined, the project starts moving quite speedily in that way. So that's the status of Canubia. The second component relating to the greening, I think the greening and the integrated development and bringing all the components to a project, if we are able to get that right as the HDA in projects, I think that would be the magic bullet almost of a project. I can say that in terms of the way a project is set up with all the spheres and all the role players' involvement and the pre-work leading to that does contribute significantly to achieving that. Let me give you an example. In Zanamvula, by having all the role players aligned, Zanamvula, the committee will recall when having visited, there aren't the schools, the clinics, the police stations. It isn't there, it's just the houses. Coming in as HDA, we've been working for quite a while now to bring in education, to clear and get the various items required from the metro to be put on the budget, to be provided so that they are put into the project. So now that we have an organizational structure and various role players come to meetings and we can talk, that program is starting to come through.
So we're starting to see the schools are being planned, the police stations are being provided, the clinics are coming. But we've got a constant engagement and we've got a structure and framework within which that can be done. And we have recommended that within the Canubia framework, so that before they build the houses, while they're doing the roads, they're already starting to think, oh, there must be a school for all the children that are going to stay in 500 houses. There must be a clinic, there must be a police station. They didn't initially think of that, and only when they came to see N2 and Zanavula did they realize the importance and the impact of building 500 houses and having those facilities there before it comes in. So, Madam Chair, it is definitely a key consideration that we're looking at. It's something that has been largely missing in the mega projects, and going forward with Canubia, we're hoping to bring those pieces together in the right way and to consider it not only at the project level but in the broader planning of the project.
Can we close the chapter?
But you know, this land issue, I really, we've been listening to this story now for how long? Okay? And it's money, 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 and we can't, whatever. We're not getting this thing through. Now I'm listening to this big, long story here, and I'm really sympathetic about process and watching all these things and so on, the meetings. But, you know, it gets to a point where you want to tear your hair up because, I mean, can I ask a question? I mean, what you have presented now to us here by way of what you're going to deliver, are we still next year going to be hearing about the process and another committee, joint committee that's been set up to take this forward? I think we've really got to get our asses into gear, you know, so that we move on. The question of Canubia, now here's a typical example, breaking new ground, 2004, and we still don't know that we've got to have integrated a whole system of clinics and schools and everything else. The airport now, which is being seemingly used as an excuse, that airport didn't just arrive with the World Cup in 2010. You know, it was planned. So, you know, I don't know where we start to crack the whip here, but gee, we can't sit around and all just sit and yes and that's fine. Please, next time you come, let's see if there's progress here, you know? We don't want to hear the big stories anymore.
It's more than a suburb. They're not giving this one. They're not giving. And they, when your father brings the not giving, it means you have committed a serious offense at home. So, your excuses, it means you can put these excuses, but really, the portfolio committee is very, very frustrated. But we do trust that you are going to make it. It's not that we don't trust you. But really, we are feeling the pinch as the politicians. So don't think that we are trying to be hard on you. We are not hard or harsh, but we would like to see you at least coming up forward with something that is going to benefit more the citizens of this country. So I would like you to respond to this one, not to say you are not doing it out of respect, but this is an issue that you have to consider very seriously. I thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Adler. You know that you are always coming before the portfolio committee. When you come next time, no stories. I'm going to go to the next one. Kupa in Okiris. So, what a protection. That offense. What about you?
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think in a nutshell, in terms of our mandate, is really to make housing finance affordable and accessible, especially to the low and middle income households. But I'd just like to start with NHFC's alignment to outcome 8, which I think is very important in terms of our programs and the initiatives that we embark upon. Firstly, our mainstay business from inception has been wholesale funding, where we fund social housing, social rental housing. At the moment, we have a good partnership with the Social Housing Regulatory Authority, SHRA, where every social housing development project, they provide the grant funding, we provide the top-up finance. And that is part of output 1 of outcome 8, accelerating delivery of housing opportunities. And also as part of the rental housing strategy of the NHFC, we also fund rental, affordable rental housing. I think mainly in the inner city, we can actually claim that the inner city development, both in Gauteng and in other parts of the country, in other provinces, KZN, and now in PE, NHFC has been instrumental in actually providing funding. Initially alone, but of late we've been able to attract private sector participants. Affordable rental housing, that has been also another area where NHFC's funding has gone great in terms of developing this affordable housing rental space. Home ownership, we have partnered with the banks in many areas, and some of these are non-banking retail lenders. That's what NBL actually stands for. Incremental housing, which is partly a complement to RALF, we have been providing that, particularly in the urban areas. Some of the clients are diverse, that they've got both rural and the urban client portfolio. So in terms of outcome 8, output 1, there's a direct link to some of the mainstay programs of NHFC. Now, of recent, output 4, which is improving property markets, this is where the three key instruments that we'd like to actually focus on for today's presentation, simply because they're the priority programs of the corporation. One is the finance-linked individual subsidy program, which is also meant to facilitate private sector or banking, increased banking sector participation in a target market. I think through the presentation, it is, we have actually spelled out to say FLIS deals with affordability challenges of the household, where households do not have enough, and what that FLIS does, it bridges that gap for people who earn between 3,500 and 15,000. And the other instrument is the mortgage default insurance, which is also meant to bring about increased participation of banks in our target market. And I think the focus there is on access, making sure that people who have been unserved up to now or underserved up to now are able to be served to a greater extent by the financial institution. So that's really the alignment of NHFC programs to outcome 8. Now, in terms of outcome 8 contributions, we have laid out a table in terms of what that actually translates into over the coming years up to 2014. In total, if one were to look at all those breakdowns, NHFC's contribution to outcome 8 delivery expectations would be around 25% of what is expected in terms of output 1 and output 4 in the main. So, Madam Chair, I would just like to highlight two key areas before I just talk just about FLISP and MDI. One is when one looks at NHFC's success or delivery progress, this is not just directly ourselves, but a lot of what we do as well, we bring private sector to participate in this segment of the market to a greater extent. Two examples that I'd like to use. Firstly, is the partnership that we have with Old Mutual, where we're participating. Our funding is very little, but Old Mutual has committed about $9.3 billion in development projects across the country, which will deliver in 10 years' time about 120 affordable units. Now, this is, to us, a success from a point of view that not all the money actually comes from NHFD, but we've been able to bring private sector on board and to have that kind of commitment, as they have actually, they've also used it in their annual report. That's exactly what they intend to deliver. The second one is we have an associate company called TAF, Trust for Urban Housing Finance, in which NHFC, we say associate because we own about 28% of that, which delivers inner-city rental, affordable rental. Now, initially, its success has been in Gauteng, and as we met in MINMEC, most MECs have expressed desire to want to know more about TAF. To that extent, TAF has now extended its reach to KZN and of recent also to PE in the Eastern Cape. The model is really that NHFC has been instrumental not only to fund TAF, but also bringing TAF to a place where it's now open to be funded by other private institutions. An example that we have at the moment is at the moment TAF inception was 2003. Today, it stands as a $1.2 billion company, having made an impact of about 18,000 units. And just before end of this financial year, TAF would move from being $1.2 billion company size to a $2 billion company. Now, that could not have happened if NHFC has not been a participant in trying to increase and scaling up delivery, particularly in the affordable rental and in the inner city development. I think the other private sector leveraging is NHFC's ability to bring funding into the human settlement space. This is funding externally. At the moment, we're funded by two multilateral agencies, which are offshore, the European Investment Bank and French Development Bank. Of recent, we have also successfully clinched another funding coming locally from one of the agencies, which is the $1.3 billion, which will be an additional funds that will be made available in the sector. That is part of our mandate to make sure that we facilitate the availability of funding so that in the end we can deliver a weighted average cost of funding or financing a house to be actually at a lower level. And, Madam Chair, key to the programs that are priority to NHFC, one is the mortgage default insurance, which, as we indicated in our presentation, at the moment we're busy with the process of getting a license from the Financial Services Board and also to have one of the banks piloting with us by May, and in July, having made sure that by 1st of October the program actually is launched. Now, the other priority in terms of dependencies on the MDI is the whole issue of 1 billion rand guarantee. Engagements with Treasury are still ongoing, and this is very critical to the success of the program, because without it, it will make the premium that the household pay to be very expensive. And therefore, this is almost a given that with the 1 billion rand guarantee, then it will make it more affordable for the household. And secondly is the FLIS program, which the state president announced and the finance minister that 1st of April it will be launched. And I must say the readiness of thereof is in place from NHFC side, but I think accompanying me here is the head of the FLIS program, Lawrence, and I'd like him maybe to comment on the progress that we've made in terms of FLIS from NHFC side and our readiness for 1st of April launch. Lawrence.
Thank you. Chairperson, the President has made an announcement. The role of the NHFC in the program is to ensure the smooth administration and the rollout of the program from the 1st of April. In that regard, We have gone to all the provinces to determine state of readiness. Having determined the state of readiness, we also determined the budget allocations that should be in place. Thirdly, we also had to look at the project. From the MINMEC approval on the revised implementation strategy for FLIST, we have to have 9 pilot projects, meaning each province should have at least one project, which will be a FLIST dedicated project. On the project side, I think we are happy to report that all the provinces would be able to have a pilot project by the 1st of April. Northwest will lead the pack in terms of state of readiness. There are 3 projects, which is Impala Phase 2, Anglo Platinum land parcel, together with Anglo Platinum, the mining company, and there's also a project in Mafikeng. In that regard, they've also allocated sufficient budget for FLIST. So it is one of the areas that are targeted. I think once we agree with the national department in terms of the launch, I think it will probably be in that province in terms of state of readiness. Yes, there are issues that are highlighted on the presentation in terms of the conclusion of implementation protocols, the reservation of FLIST funds, the conclusion of the MOUs with the bank, because FLIST, Mr. Leshaba, let me talk to a marriage proposal. In this instance, there's something similar that FLIST has to marry what we call a mortgage loan. We are happy to state that the banks are ready. We are meeting with them weekly. The commitment from the banks actually is to sign a memorandum of agreement by the 22nd of this month. We have made a lot of progress. The department also from its side, in terms of this role of the NHSC, has considered savings to cover the costs of the NHFC intervention. I think shortly that is really the update from my side. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I will just indicate one slide just that demonstrates the strategic plan overview, and thereafter we'll go back to the critical perspective. May I ask my CFO, Zonia Adams, just to go through that?
Slide 28 is a high-level overview of the strategic plan. The strategic plan itself is a 5 years, although in the presentation it only covers the 3 years. In the first year, we're planning to do 20,115 housing opportunities, leading up to 24,888 in the 25. This basically requires the disbursements of almost 1 billion a year from 1,035 in 2013. Up to 1,279, and at the back of that is the funding requirements of 750 million each for the next 3 years. I think the qualification that we included in here, that because the MDI is under, it's been finalized, these figures exclude the MDI as a separate program.
Madam Chair, I'd like just to highlight some of the critical success factors, and then we will stop there as far as the presentation is concerned. Firstly, the partnership with the 4 banks, both for FLIP and MDI, is critical. As Lawrence has indicated, the banks, I think they love FLIP more than MDI, simply because FLIP is money coming, is manna from heaven. It's state subsidy, and therefore I think that they welcome most. But I must say, from an approach standpoint as an HFC, it's a concerted approach. to say if you buy the other, you have to also deliver on the other. On the side of MDI, because it deals with the safety and soundness of the financial sector, the Reserve Bank has to give to the banks a benefit, which is to be a lower capital reserve because of all those mortgages that would be guaranteed or insured, and therefore their risk weighting will be less. The greater that is, the more attractive it will make the banks want to be participating there. I think on the social housing front, which is aligned to output one of outcome eight, our continued partnership with the SHRA, in order that we increase the delivery of affordable housing, especially social and affordable rental housing, I think is very key, because that is also one of the priority programs. The Home Loan Disclosure Act is very critical in this regard, because we need to get that feedback as to who gets declined and why are people declined, so that we can give that feedback in our ongoing engagement with the banks. I think the issue of bringing other sources of funding or expanding on the sources of funding is very critical, not only because NHFC is self-sustaining, but also to ensure that we can deliver a benefit to the household in terms of affordability. It is also true, I heard Ralph as we came in talking about the issue of indebtedness. I must say also to the portfolio committee that economically speaking, and what we're seeing happening in the affordable housing space, it is actually improving. Last year and this year are becoming different. Of recent, some of the development companies, Calgro M3 is one of those examples, RBA Homes, they actually demonstrated that they're embarking on new projects within the affordable housing space. So there is a sense that activity is taking place. Banks are also beginning to relax their lending criteria in order to make sure that more amount of money is actually lended out. I think the issue of consolidation, I think we raised it as a critical success factor. The shortest time that can be done, I think it will be better for, I think, the whole human settlement drive of scaling up the impact that we're making in this market. I think with that, Madam Chair, would like to just to stop there and maybe open for comments or questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Mkhalapa.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we welcome progress report in as far as MDI and FLIP is concerned, and moreover, what the state of readiness from the provinces. I think it's quite a welcome initiative. Just a quick question is just this housing opportunities you referred to, is the whole package of social, private, rental, is the whole package? When you're saying 20,000, they are going up until 24,000, it's the whole package? Not okay. All right. No, I think we definitely welcome, because of the two important things is the issue of the MDI and the FLIP, and we're seeing that there is collaboration with an private sector and the banks, and you know, as well as the subsidy. And I like the way that they're gonna do it. If you want FLIP, you got to also engage on MTI. So it's a give and take situation, and I think the bank should appreciate that one. Thanks, Chair.
These things are doing us today. Just as a matter of interest, in your annual performance report, this one that we have got, I'm not too sure how authentic it is if we don't have a signature for the executive authority of the National Housing Finance. But you can maybe comment on that. You've got the official sign-offs, those are all signed, but I'll just draw that to your attention. The other thing is just an interesting comment, and that is under your salary increase, am I reading this correctly, that for the year 2012, you're looking at 6.5% and 2013, 6%? If we could just understand that. Then I want to refer to
your finances here, your summary of financial performance slide, and I want to just understand the huge difference between your March 12 and there's a huge disparity here, and then it all reverts back in March 13 to your 57, you know, when you're talking about your profits. It drops right down from March 2011 to 18, and then it goes, you know, expectedly right up again, you know, that huge disparity there. And then this morning I was accusing somebody else of this computer query that I have, and it's actually in your finances. I was accusing Rolf. If you look on page 16 of your financials, your report headed financials, I just would like some explanation. You talk about outsourced services to the tune of 18 million rand. A little bit further down, you talk about under operating expenses, your computer expenses there of 7.9. Your premises are 7.5. I'm just interested to know this huge amount for computer computers, which correlates with the amount of your premises, which seems to be a little bit out of kilter. So I'd like some explanation about what that huge sum of money towards the computers is about. And then, if I may, just ask, you talk about no retail business, and I'm just wondering how this affects your staff complement, whether at all, how that affects that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't want to get an indication of the slander. Well, what is the status now in terms of the board? I think the department is going to respond to that one. And in your annual report 2010-11, there were critical issues that required to be addressed on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I just ask Zonia to respond to the financials, then I'll respond to the rest.
Thank you, Chair. I think the sign of the first question, it was signed of our Chair of the Board. I think executive authorities for the department now, which is the next signature. So it's, once the minister's approved it, he will append his signature to the plan. So it's up to our company level. It's been signed by the Chair of our Board. The second question dealing with the salaries, it is correct if in the strategic plan there is an assumption of the staff. There were vacancies during the current year, so the expectation is that it will be filled. You will notice then that the rest of our expenses, the general increase is basically 6%, and it applies to staff. On the premise that the complement will be full, and it will just be an annual increase then the onwards from 6%. And I think that 6% applies almost to all our operating costs generally. The March 12, actually in the slide, there is a slide dealing, explaining that variance, if I can just find it. Yeah, okay, there's a slide 30 gives the budget assumptions, but specifically slide 33 addresses the changes from year 12 to 13. I think if you analyze all the drivers of the income, the first one is the interest. It's based on the growth of disbursements. Budgeted disbursements is 103.5, as well as there's an increase in interest rates that we've bought in. Sale of houses, again, in the current year there were some delays, and if you look at our performance, that has not happened. So those projects are expected to come on board in the next year. impairment speaks directly to the growth of the book. The other big impact, and it speaks to the whole issue of retail, the big one single item is we've made a provision for the sale of the book. Where we are now, the book is, the preparation for the sale is still in progress. We've completed the valuation. We will be asking for the necessary approval shortly. But even in this financially, although it's in, it's more than likely that the sale will only happen in the next year, it's only prudent to provide some, make some provision in the current year. So that is the big drop in our bottom line that will come through. The return to the next year will then be back to normal. So the big increase is mainly because 12 has gone down significantly as a result of that provision that we're making. What is also evident in our financials is that I think 2012 was the first year that we started to borrow, and maybe not to the full extent, again, if you see where we are. So that the increased borrowings and the cost of borrowings is very evident then from the 2013 year onwards as well. So that slide basically tries to capture the changes in the 2012. Yeah. The issue of systems, there is one page in the strategic plan that sort of gives the detail, and I think it is, if I can just find it, it basically breaks up where the intended spend are. If I can direct you to, if you have the full strategic plan, page 83, it gives the detail of the capital expenditure plan, basically computer equipment, software equipment, furniture and fittings is very small, so the bulk of it, and it specifies on page 83 of 86 exactly under hardware what is intended as well as under software. Okay. Yeah, let me say hardware is basically replacement. The one of the big things is we're busy, we're planning to upgrade the LAN and the WAN network and infrastructure, as well as the server replacement and upgrade. Internet and intranet infrastructure is also one of the planned activities. I think on the software side, specifically, there are business applications to support the business given the change in the nature of the business and to cope with the changing risks. There are business applications upgrade planned specifically within the treasury side where we've previously not had a treasury system. The whole treasury was operated on spreadsheets. Given that we're taking on borrowing, the risks are changing. We've in the process of acquiring, in fact, we have acquired a treasury system. So those costs should be coming through. And that's one example of the planned business applications to support the growing business, as well as the management information system. So that, in a nutshell, gives a breakdown of the CapEx expenditure. Premises, also remember, this is consolidated. We it includes both NHFC as well as CTCHC. So it would be our premises in Johannesburg, as well as the CTCHC premises in Cape Town as well.
Thanks. Chair, on the issue of the disclosure, Shlamda, the board has been established. It's functional. In fact, yesterday was the first meeting that they had with, I'm sure it was two banks yesterday, and there's a whole series. So the board's in place. The minister's activated. There's a support team, the department access secretariat, for, so we can sort of confidently say for after a number of years, we have a sort of functional home loan disclosure unit, and we'll present, I suppose, in the next 6 months a progress on their work, and the reports will probably come through in conjunction with the NHSC. Thank you, Chair.
Just a last question on implications to retail staff. The staff has been reassigned. Some of the staff has been absorbed into new programs of the corporation, for instance, FLESP. Some of the staff has been moved there. So there will not be negative implications for staff. They will be actually reassigned to the other developments within the corporation. Thank you.
I think we welcome the presentation. And you know, we have got a business, long-term business with NHFC in respect of this FLISP and this MDI. So you won't be, okay, won't get frustrated whenever we're calling you now and again, because until such time it is stabled, this program is stabled, will be invited timely to the portfolio committee. I know Ani Katari and Ani Dinwar, Ni active ownership. You are Amanda, you are energetic. Thank you very much. And, we really appreciate even your company by your members of the board. It's very appreciated. It means you are a very committed and serious institution. Thank you very much, Neville, with your team, whole team, Chairman Sessions team. See you 16 and 17. Yes. But a letter is coming inviting you. I think ONHSC has also assisted me to add something in my correspondence in relation to this new development on this FLISP issue. If other provinces, how ready are the other provinces? The one in the Southwest, say, set a already set the scene on this matter. So, he let I am saying,
just one thing on the 16th and 17th. I think just given the fact that we'll have all the entities together with the provinces, it's just the venue issue. So I suppose in trying to get a venue allocated to the committee for that meeting, it should be large enough.